Welcome to Talking Books on Campus FM. I'm Patricia Camilleri, and in this series I discuss books and what they mean to my guests on the program. I'm very happy to have with me in the studio today for Talking Books, Professor Ronald Sultana. Just a few words about Professor Sultana. He was the founding director of EMCER, the Euro-Mediterranean Centre for Educational Research, and is Professor of Educational Sociology and Comparative Education here at the University of Malta. He has studied education in Malta, the UK and New Zealand, and was Fulbright Fellow at Stanford University. He's the founding editor of the Mediterranean Journal of Educational Studies and represents the region on the editorial board of several international journals of education. Professor Sultana is the author or editor of 21 volumes and has published over 90 articles and chapters in referee journals and books. His research has taken him to several countries in the Mediterranean region, Africa and Europe, and he has been involved in a number of research projects with several international agencies, including UNESCO, UNICEF, GTZ, the Commonwealth Secretariat, the EU and various ministries of education. Much of his work relates to educational innovation and evaluation and the linkages between education and development. A warm welcome to you, Professor Sultana.
Thank you.
Well, the first question that I always ask my guests is, I ask them really to delve into the recesses of their mind and go back to their sort of childhood introduction to the written word. And ask them where their obvious love of literature and reading have come from.
I didn't always like reading. I mean, I remember my sister, my elder sister, always being praised for always having a book in her hand, and I wasn't terribly interested in that until I discovered Beano and Dandy. And this was my introduction to a love of reading through comics. So it was a very unusual road into literature, I guess. And this was followed by, of course, the usual diet for most Maltese kids my age in the early 60s, which was Enid Blyton, Biggles, Tarzan, and all the rest of them, which, interestingly enough, also constituted the diet for Edward Said, who we'll be speaking about later. But I do remember long summers of boredom with these books in my hands, which helped me fly away from that particular boredom and fall in love with reading, actually. But this is the way I started reading.
I think a lot of children did, and I remember my own mother saying, it doesn't matter, you know, people say, oh, no, not comics, not good enough. Mm. And she would say, well, I don't care, she can read anything she likes, so long as she's reading, that's all she cared about.
Indeed. Mm.
And in fact, even when I was young, which wasn't, so long ago, there wasn't as much television as there is today. So we had Children's Hour, in England anyway, between 4 and 5, and I was allowed to watch that, and perhaps something between 6 and 7. And that was it, really. Television wasn't so important. So we had an opportunity, perhaps a little bit more than our own children do, to, you're younger than me, but to read. Now the distractions of the media are greater.
Right. There's so much to do. I mean, they read in other ways. I mean, the internet, of course, is always a good introduction to so many things, but they read differently. We tended to read in a linear fashion. Internet, they just go all over the place, and God help us for their spelling.
But today, I get the feeling that you're going to be joining your love of education research with obviously a profound respect for these two fascinating writers who also have a close connection with a research project, which we might mention briefly, which I know is close to your heart. About these two books, we're going to talk about Edward Said's memoir, Out of Place, and Ada Karmi's book, In Search of Fatima. These are two autobiographies. Why do they speak to you? What draws you to them as books?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I always liked autobiographies. I really read quite a number of autobiographies. But these two have a very special place in my heart, because over the past 8-10 years, I've been going to Palestine on a regular basis to do research. For example, I spent quite a lot of time during the Second Intifada in Hebron, looking at the impact of the conflict on young kids in schools, which was quite harrowing, really. I've also gone to most of the refugee camps in Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Palestine, to look at the quality of education kids receive in the camps. And most recently, just last January, I was in Gaza, which is another experience that really pushed me to my limits in terms of being able to understand why people are treated in that way and how they treat each other, in a sense, that way. It's not just a Jewish question, an Israeli question. It's also the terrible divide between the Hamas and Fatah groups. So my life has, without planning for it, been really enmeshed with the Palestinian question. And one way of making sense of this is obviously to read some of the foremost Palestinians and what they're writing, either in their political works or in these beautifully written memoirs, autobiographies by Edward Said, who started writing this book, his autobiography, his memoir, when he discovered he had leukemia, which was ultimately, after 9 years of battling with it, took him away from us. And Adar Karmi, who I coincidentally met when I was in London and heard her give a talk about the future of statehood for Palestine. And there were some of her books on sale, and I spoke with her, and we shared memories about Edward Said. And so both books to me are very special. Edward has a close connection to us in Malta, mainly through Professor of Literature, Professor Joseph Buttigieg, who often comes to Malta, actually. And I think he should be given much more space and opportunities to speak out. And he was a close friend to Edward, and thanks to him, Edward Said joined the editorial board of our journal when we launched it. He accepted to be on the board of the Mediterranean Journal of Educational Studies. Perhaps few people know that there's a Maltese cartoonist, extremely well-known, Joe Sacco, who wrote, who won a lot of awards for his depiction of the Palestinian question in cartoons, and also recently of Kosovo, the Kosovo problem. And Edward Said wrote a beautiful introduction praising Joe Sacco to the skies. And so Edward knows about Malta, and a lot of us here in Malta actually use his work either in post-colonial critical literature and literary criticism. And he certainly is a very important person to engage with. So my engagement with these books is partly political, partly personal. Particularly, I mean, you know, every week we hear something about the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Just recently there was this whole crisis around the humanitarian aid flotilla to Gaza. So reading these two books, for people who are not really interested in reading tough political treatises on the issue, but they do get a very good idea of what as they call it, the Nakba, this terrible 1948 event meant to them, and the origins of the Palestinian question.
Edward Said's and also the Karmi's book, they really are about shifting identities. Mm. They both talk about their particular problems or their challenges in their life for reasons of identity, and probably the greatness of the books lies in the fact that then they have this a universal resonance in the area of talking about identities, and their stories are the stories of all those who have similar identity challenges to deal with on a daily basis, and these challenges are sometimes difficult of definition, where you've got different nationalities, different cultures within mm-hmm. within nationalities, as you've just mentioned. Here in Malta, we discuss our Maltese identity a lot, mm-hmm. and sometimes perhaps it comes across as a bit monolithic. that, you know, Maltese, we're all Maltese together, and the flag and the song and the hymn and all the rest of it. These are books about people who don't find their identities very easy to cope with.
That's right. I mean, both books are about the search for identity, and the search for identity as Palestinians, who at the same time are what we can call hyphenated Palestinians, in the sense that they're not just Palestinians, they're also Egyptian in the case of Edward Said. He spent much of his childhood in Egypt, and I mean, he surprised many Arabs who considered him to be Palestinian. When he spoke Arabic, he spoke in a very Egyptian accent, dialect. Of course, Carmi, if you hear her speak, I mean, it's almost, you know, the Eton-type English that she speaks, as did Edward himself. I mean, a very dapper, very almost dandy-like person who spoke English to perfection, of course, even though he himself said that he could never decide whether he felt more comfortable in Arabic or in English, and decided that he felt really comfortable in neither of them. So both have a very complex approach to identity. Edward Said, for example, often refers to that Walt Whitman line in one of his poems, where he said, "I am multitude, I am many, I am multitude." So, and in a lot of his works, Edward Said contests very powerfully this notion of monolithic identity. He was very critical of Huntington's thesis, the clash of civilizations, and his argument was that because of empire, our identities are so complex. They are layers upon layers of different cultures, and to try to essentialize our own identity and pigeonhole it is not only wrong historically, faulty at a historical level, but it's also extremely dangerous because it gives the rise to all sorts of terrible nationalisms and exclusion of the other. And a lot of his work is actually about that. It's about how we create the other. Orientalism, for example, which is his most famous book, is the one that probably made him the superstar in academia. Is precisely about that. It's about how literature, and that's where post-colonial literature, actually the literary study of post-colonial literature, including people like, for example, Edgar Barrow Rice with Tarzan and Rudyard Kipling with The Jungle Book and so many of the others that we are familiar with and that we was our staple diet as we were growing up, how that literature written by a colonizing empire represents the other in particular ways so that they can dominate them more. So it's about a question of trying to represent the other in particular ways, which then, of course, one can take into the way, for example, Hollywood represents Arabs in film, particularly post-September 11, and the essentializing of the Arab as swarthy, olive-skinned, lascivious, and of course a terrorist. I mean, I have had huge amounts of troubles in airports because of my surname, Sultana. And that reminds me of another very interesting discussion within the book of Edward Said, where he reflects on this other hyphenation, Edward, so typically English, so typically British and upper crust, and then Said, and which is also a little bit my story. Ronald, God knows where they got that name from, and Sultan, of course, which is sounds terribly Arabic, or beautifully Arabic, depending on how you look at it. But this, again, this shift. And Edward thinks through the problems of being a Christian in a majority Muslim context, of being Arabic in an American or British context, and so on and so forth. So these are very important debates, I think.
I love the discussion about his relationship with his father, this successful businessman who was a lover of America, and he saw in America somehow the ideals he was looking for, and he used to get very annoyed with Edward Said if in some way he denigrated at all the American way of life. It's strange to see this Arab man so very keen on American life. Of course, it was a different epoch, a different time.
Right, right. Wadi, I think his name was, comes across as a very Victorian in a way, very very stiff,
cold and prudish.
Yes, very cold, very very tough father, who is also has bought into the hegemonic discourse of who is superior to who, and I don't think he really identified himself very much as Arab, as an Arab, and there's only one phrase that Edward Said remembers where his father said, "We lost everything in Palestine. We lost everything." That was the only time that he felt that his father actually identified himself through that "we" with the Palestinian cause. And actually, Edward's politicization really started, of course, it, for both him and for Karmi, it started with 1967. 1967 was a very, very important year for all the Arab world. There had been, you know, quite a lot of pan-Arabic sentiment through Nasser's speeches. Nasserian socialism was extremely important to the in the Arab world. It made a lot of Arabs feel at least two things, as far as I can understand. One, that there was this community of Arabs, which of course was already captured by the notion of the Ummah, of the Islamic world, of being part of an Islamic community, but this went into the politics of being part of an Arab world, and also the pride of being an Arab, which was new, which was something that Nasser managed to give and then lose in a terrible, terrible way, which Karmi actually describes so beautifully in her autobiography. About, you know, the when Nasser lost the war with Israel, and how shameful and embarrassing and awkward it was to see all those planes in the airfield just being, you know, shot at by Israeli air power. So Edward Said and Karmi became very politicized, both of them in 1967. But prior to that, I mean, Edward has this beautiful description of his auntie, who used to take care of refugees in Cairo and cater for them in her own humble way, in her own limited way. But he could at least, he had one role model of somebody who was dedicated to the Palestinian refugee. And the Palestinian refugees in both volumes, I mean, both Edward Said and Karmi are refugees. I mean, both had to leave Palestine, particularly so Karmi, who was living in Jerusalem and had to leave at age 8. And there are some really beautiful descriptions, especially very touching, is since I've just lost my dog and feel sad about that, about leaving behind Rex, her dog. Very touching. Now, you wouldn't get that in a history book at school, would you? But you do get this in this particular text. And just that story of a young 8-year-old girl not really knowing what was happening around her, looking back in the car which is taking her to her grandparents in Damascus, and knowing somehow, deep down, feeling that she's never going to see Rex again. And her,
or her nanny.
Or her nanny, who is Fatima, in case our readers think that this is about Fatima, the other Fatima that most Catholics would know of, who was actually her ersatz mother, her real mother in many ways, Fatima. I think that is the stuff that history is made of, really.
Yes, the personal bits that the historian perhaps can't actually express.
Right, right.
And in Damascus, they didn't find happiness either, did they? They found it difficult in Damascus.
Yes, yes. And neither in Damascus, and it wasn't easy for them either in the UK, where they settled down in London. As luck would have it, or irony would have it,
among
which is a Jewish enclave. But still, and this is very important, I mean, in case our listeners think that, you know, because of their political views about Palestine and the right of return for the refugees, you know, the 4.5 million refugees that there are in the world now today, that these are anti-Israeli in a bigoted way. Not at all. I mean, both of them had strong friendships with Jews. Carmi, for example, recalls playing with Jews, even when she was in Jerusalem, with these German Jews that had come, who were non-aggressive and who were obviously looking for their own roots in many ways. And, I mean, we know that Edward Said, for example, set up this East-West Divan Orchestra with Daniel, which used to meet in Seville. It's to try to get Christians, Jews, and Arabs to play together in an orchestra. I mean, people would know that Edward Said was himself of concert pianist standard, so he was really into music, and he felt that that kind of language of music could overcome the barriers between the Palestinians and Jews. Both of them speak of two communities of suffering, and I think this is a beautiful phrase. Mm-hmm. I have seen a lot of suffering in Palestine, and it was so bad that I felt, you know, I had this conflict between feeling so much anger and so much sympathy for the Palestinian cause and anger at the Israelis, and trying to bridge that with my friendship with quite a lot of Israeli academics. And I remember crossing over from Ramallah on one research project, and going to the university, the Hebrew University on Mount Scopus, just outside Jerusalem, and wanting to meet some my Israeli friends and actually speak with them about what I had seen. And they were very interested, although I remember a terrible phrase, which I understand at a psychological level. You know, we don't know exactly what's happening on the other side. And to be frank, we don't really want to know, because it's too much to handle. How do you handle things like that? And this is precisely what Edward Said and Carmi do. They throw it back in our face. They make the international community remember that there is a Palestinian people, despite all efforts to deny their existence, and to make us forget about them as a people. That Golda Meir was known to have said there are no Palestinians, for example. And this is a very powerful statement in the sense that this is a people that is trying to find its roots because they too are a community of suffering. I mean, another thing I did was I felt really obliged to do this. I went to Auschwitz in order to balance these very problematic feelings that I had when I was in Palestine. And Auschwitz, it's
mind-blowing, isn't it?
Yes. There is a very important essay by Adorno, who is a Jewish social philosopher, very, very important. I teach some of his works with my students. They come from what is called the Frankfurt School of Social Philosophers. And he has this mind-blowing essay called Education After Auschwitz, which basically says that education cannot ever be the same after Auschwitz. And if you've been to Auschwitz, I mean, it is a terrible place. And
you come out different.
Yes, you cannot come out untouched. No.
Everyone says the same thing. I haven't been there myself, but I know several people who have.
And it's an important experience that most people should actually strive to do, because it tells us about the horrors that we can inflict on each other. But precisely because of Auschwitz, and precisely because of what we learned from those terrible years, these two communities of suffering cannot keep on imposing suffering on each other. So it's a quite an important autobiographical approach to this very, very sad story of these two communities. I think Edward and Carmi try to keep a balance between talking about their own suffering, which represents the suffering of their whole people, without instilling hatred, which is not an easy thing to do, because I mean, we've had experiences of this internationally with Ireland, for example, and with South Africa, and the hope that these two countries who have somehow overcome these differences found a way of living, well, or trying to live peacefully together. Now, what is interesting about both Karmi and Said is that they have their own views about what the future should be for Palestine and Israel. And strangely enough, or perhaps not that strangely, their view is very different to what is now consensual, which is now people speak about a two-state solution, while both of them seem to promote a one-state solution. If anything, Edward Said thought about the two-state solution only as an interim. And he was, both Karmi and Said make a very strong case for a one-state solution where the two groups and live together. And even there, what these autobiographies remind us is even when we talk about two groups, we're not really talking about the two groups, we're talking about a multiplicity of groups. I mean, very few people talk about the injustices and domination between different groups of Jews, for example, the Ashkenazi and the Sephardic Jews, the Orthodox and those who are secular, and the strife that there is between these communities. Same with the Palestinians. I mean, when we do research on Palestinian societies, for example, we are careful not to simply fall into the trap of talking about the domination coming from Israel and the oppressed being the Palestinians. There are Palestinian dominant groups that oppress their fellow Arabs, Palestinians, including, there are huge tensions at the moment between a much more aggressive, assertive Islam and the minority of Christians. There used to be 11% Christians in Palestine. There's hardly 3% left. People are leaving. And partly it is to do with this search for identity under conditions of occupation, which are expressed through connections with religion in particular ways, or the oppression of males over females. I mean, in my studies, for example, I've come across girls who are really, really, I mean, sharp, intelligent girls whose life have been, whose own development has been stunted by the fact that they are girls, simply because of the fact they are girls. So,
well, we've come to the end of our time, unfortunately. It's such an interesting subject. I would like to have gone on talking about it. And these two books are certainly an example of two autobiographies that can certainly give amazing insights into a complex question such as the Palestinian situation. Well, thank you very, very much, Professor Ronald Sultana, for coming to talk to us about it today.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Talking Books. I hope you can join us next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.